Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we've got a great show for you today. You know, I've had a lot of questions over the years from people about what the different career kind of paths and settings are like in anesthesiology. We've touched on this a little bit in terms of talking to some folks in private practice, obviously lots of folks in academics, but we haven't had a show dedicated to really kind of comparing and contrasting different options within the field of anesthesiology. And that is what we're going to do today. And I think it's going to be fantastic. We've got some great guests. Back again is Dr. Mike Esando, who, as frequent listeners will know, is a professor of anesthesiology at The Ohio State University, primarily focusing in cardiac anesthesia. And he's also involved as an assistant dean for graduate medical education, so has that role too in academics. We also have a new guest on the show who I'm excited to have, Dr. Kyle Chomey, who is a general anesthesiologist and recently completed his obligation serving in the United States Air Force. So he'll be able to give us a little bit of information about what a career in the military in anesthesiology looks like. And then we have another return guest, the one and only Dr. Joe Cody, who, as listeners will know, was first on the show when he was a fellow with Dr. Esando at Ohio State, and now is in private practice doing both cardiac and general anesthesiology. So we are going to cover everything from the hardcore academic setting to the military to private practice. And I think this will be really helpful for people. So for Joe, Kyle, and Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Jed.
Thank you. Thank you, Jed.
So let's start in academics. And Mike, we're going to start with you. You've obviously been very successful in academic medicine and academic anesthesiology. So let me ask you first, what made you choose to work in academics? Obviously, you did a residency and then a fellowship. You could have gone into private practice. As far as I know, you did not. I think you've only been in academics, but correct me if I'm wrong. But what has made you go into and stay in academics?
All right. Jed, thanks for the opportunity to have us back at ACRAC. I had the privilege of training at Cleveland Clinic. So I did my undergraduate medical education at Penn State, and then I went to Cleveland Clinic for anesthesiology residency and fellowship. And during that time, I was very fortunate to really be in the midst of really great academicians. And I can name a few that, you know, come to mind, you know, Dr. Robert Savage, Dr. Colleen Cook, Dr. Alfirovich. And all these really brilliant minds were really a reflection of what it felt like to be, you know, an academician. They were great clinicians. They were great research scientists. They really were passionate about education and training of, you know, the next generation of clinicians. And they also were contributors, not locally in the Cleveland clinic, you know, but they contributed across the whole stratosphere in every aspect of anesthesiology and other administrative roles. They published transformative, you know, research that really changed the way we practice anesthesiology today. Dr. Cook, for example, did a whole lot of work in leadership and blood management and cardiac surgery. Dr. Savage is one of the founding fathers of transesophageal echocardiography, and the whole host of, you know, contributions goes on from there. So during my training, I always wanted to be one of those guys. So I did not even consider a private practice job, even though, you know, I knew that there were other aspects of, you know, private practice job that was also appealing. For example, the salary scale is quite different between the academics and the private, you know, enterprise. But I didn't even consider it because I wanted to basically contribute to medicine and all the, you know, the pillars of medicine, right? I wanted to be a great clinician. I wanted to be a research scientist. I wanted to educate and train the next generation of anesthesiologists. And most importantly, I wanted also to learn from them. Because if I look back, I never reflect on my career because I don't really think I've achieved what I want. You know, because everybody has their personal goals. But when I reflect on my career, the majority of what people may think is an accomplishment came from all the residents and fellows that I've encountered, you know, in my training. Specific example pertaining to ACRAC, right? I had the opportunity to come on ACRAC because Dr. Joseph Cody was my fellow, and he had the links with you, and he said, let's go on ACRAC and talk about, you know, cardiac implantable electronic devices. And that's how we started in the podcast, you know, arena, and it's gone, you know, on from there. So to sum it up, I really did not even seek private practice opportunities. I did not even interview at any private practice job. I felt the academic, you know, space was where I truly belonged. And I also felt like, you know, although in the private enterprise, you can do research. Obviously, clinical care is done everywhere. You can do research in private practice. You can do, you know, speaking engagements. You can educate, you know, residents and fellows, nurses, whoever you encounter. I felt that the network of collaborators that I needed to make me successful as an anesthesiologist would mostly be, you know, found in the academic enterprise. And I think that was a really great choice because at Ohio State, I can name a list of people who have influenced my career. I call them my own personal network of co-mentors. And they go from a whole host of like professors such as Dr. Awad, who is an anesthesiologist, Dr. Emil Daoud, who is the chair of electrophysiology, who basically, you know, so Dr. Daoud just one day serendipitously just said, hey, we're working on the SICD. We're working on the ID study. Ohio State is the lead enroller. Why don't you look at the anesthetic implications for patients? And that's how my career in the EP space, you know, started. So, and then another example of, you know, so that's a collaborators. These are collaborators who are full professors. Then I have collaborators who are, were assistant professors, Dr. Manoj Iyer, associate professors, Dr. Flores. And then another person that's been, you know, two people that have also, you know, contributed tremendously to my career as a med student by the name of, you know, Nick Kumar, who was on your podcast. We're doing cases, you know, I kept talking about, you know, finding thresholds to identify patients on LVADs, receiving LVADs who may be at risk for early right ventricular dysfunction. And Nick, you know, was very instrumental in, you know, helping us execute that task. So in a nutshell, I felt the academic environment was the best place to really identify innovative solutions to complex problems, because residents keep asking questions and you have to find, you know, innovative, you know, solutions to these anesthetic issues. And I think that was my main, you know, in a nutshell, those are my reasons.
Yeah, great. And a lot of that rings true for me as well. I'm in the same boat as you. As you know, Mike, I've never been in private practice and knew kind of even before med school, when I decided to go into medicine, that I would want to be in academics and want to be very involved in teaching and learning in that way. So let me ask you this. One thing I have noticed for sure is that if you're in academics, especially if you do a fellowship and subspecialize, which you have in cardiac, which I have in critical care, you really are very siloed in your clinical practice, right? So I haven't done OB anesthesia since I was a resident. I haven't taken care of kids, at least young kids, since I was a resident. And I imagine it's similar for you. Do you ever miss that? Do you ever miss kind of having that broad practice since you're very specialized?
Yes, Jed, this is an excellent question. So this is one of the aspects of academic medicine that I do miss a little bit, but over the years, I think it was a great decision not to, quote unquote, do all aspects of anesthesiology. I feel like in the day-to-day practice, you know, of in my world as a cardiac anesthesiologist, the only way to transform or advance the field is to do it every day to help you identify trends, help you refine your approaches to patient care, and even get a better and deeper understanding of what the surgeons do. So my practice in Ohio State is, you know, as a cardiac anesthesiologist, we do cardiac, vascular, transplants, EP, and thoracic. And my research has also grown in those areas. So especially in like transplantation, when I was a fellow, I would basically speak with most of my attendants. And we had no idea at the Cleveland Clinic, and this is not, I'm not basically speaking, you know, negatively about the clinic, but this was a global issue. There was no threshold of a pulmonary vein velocity that was predictive of pulmonary vein stenosis or dysfunction in a lung transplant, you know, patient. And I kept thinking about it as a resident and then as a fellow, and I still didn't have this threshold. Then I became an attendant. I was able to get a group of people that practice cardiac anesthesiology at Ohio State, and we kept thinking about this complex, you know, problem. And we were able to come up with a systematic review which identify that threshold velocity. And I think, and then the same space as, you know, like the paper we did with, which Dr. Cody is the lead author, when Dr. Cody was a fellow two, three years back, there was a transformation. There was a huge shift from transvenous lead-based pacing and defibrillators to devices that are leadless and regarding the leadless pacemakers and devices for defibrillation that were not transvenous. That was a subcutaneous implantable cardioverter defibrillator. And I kept, you know, I gave a lecture on it, and Dr. Cody essentially came to me afterwards, brought the ASA practice advisory on cardiac implantable electronic devices. And there was no mention on these novel devices and how we should manage them. And Joe's diligence led to the creation of the only document in the anesthesiology literature that addresses how these devices should be managed perioperatively. So even though I miss a little bit of not being able to do OB, PEDS, and all the other stuff that you would do in a private enterprise, I think to be in the academic arena and focusing on just cardiovascular, thoracic, and EP, those have provided me with opportunities that I would not have had if I was a general anesthesiologist. So by publishing, identifying deficits, gaps in, you know, these aspects of our subspecialty has also led to publications, has led to speaking engagements, and it provides you with that quote unquote expert, you know, recognition, but also to get promoted. To be, as a matter of fact, it's easier to get promoted when you have a focus on one area, become an expert, and then you can become promoted in your academic institution. So I do miss it, but I'm happy with, you know, where I'm at.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I feel the same way, that I certainly miss some of that. And yet I think that if you find a niche for yourself, you gain a lot of satisfaction, as you have described, from really feeling like you gain expertise in that area, that you can take that area further, ask questions in that area that you might not have time or inclination to ask if you were stretched across multiple different types of anesthesia. So pros and cons for sure. But for folks who are interested, I think that makes sense to me as well. Let me ask you this. You've been very successful. Clearly, you're a full professor. You've published extensively. You speak nationally and perhaps internationally. You perhaps most impressively have been one of the most frequent contributors to the ACRAC podcast. So you have had a ton of success academically. You've talked well already about how important mentors have been to you throughout. And I think that is something we hear a lot. Success is really dependent on a very reliable network of mentors. What else would you recommend? What other advice would you give to people who are interested in not only being in academics, but having success in academics that you can translate from your own experience?
All right. Excellent question, Jed. So, well, I'll be honest with you. I don't consider myself to be successful because I don't really reflect on my career. I think my kids keep me grounded because once you walk through the doors at home, you're nothing, right? You just have to drive them around and make sure you have the, you know, the ability to get them what they want. So, but regarding, you know, academic success, I think the first thing that you have to, in order to be, you know, you have to have your personal goals, because we have a whole host of, you know, mentors, right? And you don't want to be pigeonholed into, I want to be this and this and that. You have to have your own goals. If you want to be like, if you want to publish, you have to have that, you know, diligence. You have to have the passion to do it. Unfortunately, you know, during residency and fellowship, we do a lot of clinical work, right? You're in the ORs, you're there late, you may, you know, speak at a conference, present an abstract, or maybe be contribute to a research paper or a book chapter. But we don't learn enough about all the nuances, all the stuff that you have to do when you become an attendant. So you have to teach, you have to speak, you have to mentor, you know, a whole host of, you know, undergrads, med students, residence fellows. And then you also have to contribute locally on all the different, you know, committees that are in your hospital. And then you have to contribute nationally. So I think you have to first define what your personal goals are, so you don't feel like you're missing something. if you don't want to be an academician who writes and, you know, publishes, that's fine. But you, if you want to publish, but you don't want to put in the work, you're not going to be satisfied because you're not going to have those papers, you know, as the end product, you know, as sort of like a satisfaction. So if you want to publish, which I think is a requirement, you have to learn how to do it. It's just like any skill. The more you write, the better you write. Same as speaking. The more you speak, the better you become as a speaker. Teaching. The more you teach, the better you become a teacher. So you have to really practice these skills so you can refine them and get better at them. But it requires that internally. So internally, you want to have a lot of diligence. You have to be resilient. I can tell you how many papers I've had rejected. You get the rejection, don't feel dejected. I consider rejections as having a group of peers that are reviewing your paper and giving you guidance on how to make it better. So you take whatever rejections you get, look at the reviewers' comments, improve upon the paper, and send it to another journal. Dr. Savage always used to say to me as a resident and as a fellow, every paper has a home, and it just requires you to do the work and just refine it and, you know, and then get it published. So if you consider success to be promotions, that's also one aspect that people become dejected because they stay in one level for years and then they wonder, why am I not getting promoted? A simple advice is you have to know the requirements of your institution. So if I want to be promoted at Ohio State, I'm not going to look at the requirements of Johns Hopkins. I printed out the promotions and tenure guideline for Ohio State. And then you look at all the different tracks. Are you a clinician scholar? Are you a clinician educator? Are you a clinical excellent type of person? Or do you want to be on the tenure track? I felt the clinical scholar was fit my abilities. And then I just looked at the requirements and I kept checking them off to meet them. So that enabled me to be promoted at, I would say, a little bit of a rapid pace, because I really knew what, you know, knowing what the rules are for the academic game, quote unquote, enables you to be successful. So for anybody that wants to be, quote unquote, successful in academics, have your goals, know what the requirements are pertaining to your institution, and you have to do the work. And also, I would always encourage you, you cannot do this alone. When I look at all my publications, over 80 to 90% of them has a resident, a fellow, another collaborator from another institution, and even collaborators who are not anesthesiologists. You need people with different ideas. You need a diversity in thought to be able to come up with all these concepts. So Joe's publication on cardiac implantable electronic devices, he essentially recruited collaborators from Cleveland Clinic, Massachusetts General Hospital, University of California, San Diego, and I'm missing one other institution. And all these eight authors came together and created this document. So you cannot do it alone. It's doable, but it required too much time. You want others to bring ideas. And also think about it as an idea meritocratic system, right? Don't fight over positions. I have to be first author all the time. No, it does not matter. It's about who does the most work, who brings up that idea, and then you just keep encouraging each other to get the job done. So I think those are really some of the guidance that I'll tell people. I made a lot of mistakes along the way, but reflecting backwards, I think just having a team where everybody trusts each other, like-minded people, you don't have that, you know, somebody try, you know, there's no jealousy, and then you just, you know, work and hold each other accountable.
Yeah, I think that's all great advice. I would add, I think a lot of people get intimidated. Maybe they are in residency. Maybe they don't really have time to do much in the way of academic productivity. They don't publish anything. They've maybe never published anything, or not more than maybe a, you know, a book chapter or something like that. And they, you know, they have the idea in their head that there's colleagues of theirs who are MD PhDs and they've published, you know, 25 things before they even got to residency. And, you know, and it may feel like, ah, I can't do it, right? This is not for me. And I would say there are plenty of people, and I include myself in this, who have never published anything before finishing training, and you still absolutely can do it. That's one of the really hugely nice things about being at an academic center is that you're surrounded by mentors, people who can help you learn how to do the work if you want to do it and if you're willing to put the time in, as you said, Mike. And so I would encourage people, don't think that because you've never done it, you're out of the game. It is absolutely doable. You have to take your time, find people to work with, collaborate with, people who can mentor you and help you along the way, and put in the work, and you can do it if that's what you want to do.
And Jed, I'll add one little point that I always hear, especially young career, you know, anesthesiologists, they always say this. People want dedicated, protected time to write. There are centers that will give you that time, but it also comes at a cost, salary scale reduction. Or even if you get 20, 30 days, which is, you know, dispersed throughout the whole year, oftentimes when you have that day, that's not the day that all the ideas, all the solutions to these complex problems are going to, you know, come to you. So Dr. Dowd was very profound. I remember when I got to, you know, the Ohio State, I had published one article, which I made, you know, very minimal contributions. He just told me, just take your time. An introduction is maybe 5-10 sentences. Maybe you write 1 or 2 sentences a day. Just break it down to very small aspects, you know, of the process. Because same with, like, you know, a perfect example, like if you look at how Pixar created their first animated movie, I think it took them 15 to 20 years or something like that. And it took little steps for them to create that movie. And if you told any anesthesiologist to take that time to write a paper, people will be dejected. So it's a slow process. When once you get a hang of it, it becomes really easy. Ideas come to you, people come to you to collaborate with, and then all of a sudden you have a whole host of, you know, publications. And then you have like a mentorship tree where you mentor people locally, people, you know, nationally and internationally. All you need in this day and age, in this digital revolution, all you need is a computer, and you can collaborate with anybody to create, you know, scientific work.
Yeah, fantastic. Let me ask Mike briefly, in your role as a graduate medical education dean, talk a little bit about that. You know, if that's an additional role, obviously one does not have to have that role in order to be in academics, but you do. Talk a little bit about what that entails.
Fantastic. So my background, you know, when I came out of residency and fellowship, I wanted to be a great clinician. So my first 3 years, I was just focused on clinical work, and I slowly added research, speaking, you know, consulting for other industries. And then I wanted to pivot, you know, I wanted the next, you know, challenge, and I was very fortunate. And this is where mentorship and having sponsors comes into play. Dr. Ernie Mazzaferri, who is the director of our Ross Heart Medical Center, came to me and said, hey, there's this opportunity. I think, you know, you relate well with our learners. You seem to be interested in research education. I think there's this role of the assistant dean of graduate medical education. Maybe you should, you know, apply for it. And he thought I would be a good fit. I had never been a program director, so I didn't have that background, but I felt like I work hard and I always want to learn. And I really wanted to, you know, devote some of my attention abilities to improving graduate medical education at Ohio State. Not that it was in a bad state, but I thought I could also contribute, you know, to it. So I applied, and luckily enough, I did. I was selected to serve in this role, and I've been in this capacity for 2.5 years. I was onboarded during the pandemic, so I was able to learn how to virtually onboard incoming residents and fellows to Ohio State University. And by doing so, I think one of the things that was not really a deficit, but something that we could do better was we weren't publishing a high volume scholars, you know, work from the GME space. So we were able to, based on my experience, we were able to publish our virtual approaches to orientation, and still the only manuscript available teaching how you can do it by virtually onboarding, you know, residents and fellows to your center in the COVID space that required, you know, social distancing. And then I also am very close to the residents and fellows because I work close with them in the OR. I also learned some of the things that would have fostered their ability to be efficient in their work. And I bring it to the dean. My immediate boss, the associate dean, Dr. Scott Holliday, said, I think, given the residents and fellows laptops so they can work remotely and social distance would also make them very efficient, so they don't need all the, to be in close proximity where we have desktops. So we're able to do that. So innovative solutions to things that may be the standard program director may not be thinking of, I was able to bring that from my experience working with, the industry, working in the clinical space, and also contributing with other collaborators in other institutions. And I think that has made me, learn. And I think I'm up to speed now in the GME space. And I also learned a lot about the accreditation system, and we created well-being initiatives. We're able to build a workout facility in the hospital so our residents and fellows can use it during their downtime. So I think bringing that diversity and experience and thought, and also there was demographic, diversity as the only African-American in the GME office, African-American male, I was able to share some ideas that help with our residents and fellows. So it's been a good experience. And I will say this, a lot of people want to basically plan their careers. It's really hard to plan your career because you may not get everything that you want. But I think if you prepare and stay ready, opportunities will come your way if you do all the things that are required in the academic space.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. One thing I think we would be helpful for people would be to just kind of hear a day in the life. And of course, that can be a lot of different things, but an average day in the life. So let me sketch out what I kind of think of as an average day in the life of an academic anesthesiologist. And Mike, you can add or subtract. But, I think, again, there's going to be days for you when you have something involving your dean role. For me, there are obviously days I spend on being program director. But just when you think of that aside, just being an academic anesthesiologist, I think for most people at an academic center, you are going to, on any given day, either work with residents or CRNAs or one of each. People should probably know that if you work with residents, you cannot have more than two rooms that you supervise at a time. So you can have two rooms each with a resident. You can have one room with a CRNA and one with a resident, but you cannot have more than two rooms if either of them has a resident in it. If you are only supervising CRNAs, you can supervise more rooms. But let's talk about the resident situation. You'd have one or two rooms with residents. You would talk to those residents, I think, at most places the night before, via either phone or in person or maybe text or email, depending on the practice at your center, to talk about the cases for the next day and plan your anesthetic. And then the next morning, as the attending, you would show up. Your resident would see the patient probably first in pre-op. You would then stop by, say hello to the patients, check in with your resident. The resident would have set up the room. So, you don't have to go set up an operating room unless you're working alone without a resident, which is possible. But most days you're probably working with residents. And so you would have the rooms already set up by them. And then you'd start one of your cases with the resident. So the resident would do the intubation. You'd help them if needed, supervise that and any lines that need to be placed. And then you would do your other room where you would do the same thing. And then throughout the day, you're both supervising, teaching, helping with intubations, extubations, lines, and any problems that come up. You're probably seeing patients in pre-op so that they're ready for the next case in each of your rooms. You're giving morning breaks, lunch breaks, maybe afternoon breaks as well to your residents. Maybe if you're lucky, you're grabbing some food for yourself at some point in there. And then you're either finishing your cases for the day or being relieved at some point by another attending. And then the cycle starts again. Now, it can be a little different. As I said, some days you're going to be doing, depending on your role, you may be doing research. Some days Mike may be involved with GME things. Plenty of days I'm obviously doing residency dedicated work. But for the clinical side, I think that encapsulates it. Mike, anything you would add or change there?
No, I think you stated it. I echo everything that you said. You're 100% correct. It's always a mix. You have meetings during the day. You would, but the workflow, everything you stated is absolutely correct. And that's basically how my career has been. But you're right. There'll be days that you have things, a day dedicated to either GME or to, program director role. But the most of the time in the academic practice, you are, the attending, anesthesiologist. And I think one thing that may be a little not related to this, but I always want to emphasize this because a lot of my residents bring up this question, like, how do you manage your time and how do you do work-life, quote-unquote, balance? And I just want to share with everyone that I think it's work-life integration, because you cannot put your career on hold till your kids are older. And because at that point, people may not even consider you to be a hardworking person, or, you know, because there's always a lot of talent that is coming. So I think work-life integration is the best. You know, a lot of oftentimes some of my research has been done during my kids' basketball game when they have like a break and I have my phone, I can even write my thoughts. So with this era of the digital revolution, you can do anything wherever and whenever. And I don't think you should put one thing on hold for the other. And you know, Joe can attest to it. Sometimes I'll call him from the gym and we'll talk about ideas for research, and then we come up with topics. So I know that was a little bit outside the scope of that a day in the life, but I just want to emphasize to the listeners that it's everything we're talking about is doable. You just have to manage your time, and you need a great social support. You know, my wife and kids are always supportive of everything I do, and I still dedicate time to be a father and a husband.
Yep, totally agree. So the only thing I would add to this discussion of academic careers is the one thing that I do that Mike does not is being a program director. And I would say that that's something I enjoy immensely. It's probably the best part of my job. And being involved in resident education in that way, I mean, one of the nice things about being in academics is that you're going to be involved in resident education, you're going to teach residents. But having that opportunity, if you really are passionate about it, to get involved in program leadership, whether that's as a fellowship, in the fellowship role of a kind of fellowship program director, or the residency side, or even on the medical student side. But being able to be involved in medical education is, I think, a really wonderful thing about academics, and something that's been a real central part of my career. So I love that. And then obviously you can have a balance, and it's not that this isn't possible in private practice, but certainly I think in academics, it's pretty common to do a subspecialty, in my case, critical care. And then I spend about half my clinical time in the ICU and the other half in the OR. Having that balance is very nice. I don't think, although, you know, Kyle and Joe can certainly correct me if they have a different view of this, that it's as common in private practice to have, at least for critical care, to do kind of a half and half critical care and OR type job. Certainly Joe will talk to us about how he is able to do, I think, some cardiac anesthesia and general anesthesia. That's maybe more common. But being able to have a subspecialty like critical care and balance it with some OR, I think is a nice piece of my job as well. Okay, so we've covered academics, I think, pretty well. Let's turn to something I know a lot less about, the military careers. And Kyle, we're gonna talk to you. Tell us a little bit about how you learned about a medical career in the Air Force and how you got involved and what the pathways are for people to do medicine, or in this case, anesthesiology, in the military.
All right. Well, thanks again, Jed, for having me on. With regards to finding out about Air Force and their benefits for a medical career, ultimately, I would say it came up during the application process. I'm sure everyone that applies for medical school is going to see advertisements from all of the branches on, benefits of paying for medical school, as well as assisting you throughout medical school with other payments and covering all your expenses. So that's probably when I first heard about it. I would say that the process really starts after your MCAT scores are finally in. That's when the most branches will start to take your phone calls and start the application process. And at that point is when, if you have, at least specifically for the Air Force, they always fill 100% of their scholarship slots and have to deny some, and not so much for the other branches. But if you have a MCAT score above a certain amount and you got acceptance letters to at least one medical school, you are already accepted with the scholarship, even before deciding on which medical school. It doesn't matter to the military or the Air Force in general, as long as you have one and you commit to going, essentially. So from there, ultimately, I could talk about kind of the pathway to becoming an anesthesiologist from that point. You'll end up doing about 5 weeks of basic training, commissioned officer training, ahead of time in Montgomery, Alabama. I think it may be a little different now, but that's all before you even go to medical school. So it's kind of a wake up call on military life. You've just finished the MCAT, all this, studying your chemistry, biology, and all of a sudden now you're in you're wearing your camo and kind of marching around. It's kind of a sight to see with all these young docs and without having any idea what they're doing, but it's kind of gets you integrated into the system and kind of what to kind of maybe look forward to in the future. But after that point, you have almost no exposure to the military for 4 years in med school. Your job is to study, do well, and, you know, get into a residency program. At that point, they're going to pay for all of your medical school, all of your books, supplies, required equipment. And then they also pay you a stipend for, it's probably a little higher now, but maybe around $30,000 a year to live off of. And at that point, probably around the end of your third year is when you start to really consider, well, what actual specialty you want to get into, because the military match is a little different and they match earlier in the process than any other civilian sites. And what that does is the Air Force, essentially the easiest way to explain it is that they decide in the future, in 4 years, I need 20 some anesthesiologists in the service this year. Well, the Air Force can only train maybe 8 to 10 at San Antonio. So they need 10 additional ones. So then they, what they do is civilian deferred. And of those civilian deferred spots, a couple may be civilian sponsored where you're paid as an active duty member. The hospital doesn't have to pay your salary, but you go as a resident in the civilian side and earn active duty years. Those are rare. They're not the norm. A lot of times, like myself, you prefer to train civilian side. So you rank civilian deferred instead of a military spot as your number one choice in that military match in December. And if you get accepted, then you continue on the civilian match process. And at that point, once you, you know, get into a civilian program, you continue as working as a civilian resident without any military service until the end of it. That process is very similar with the fellowship part as well. At the end, the residency, the fellowship, you gain a 2-year commitment for every year you are on a fellowship. So that's a big deciding factor towards the end of residency, if kind of what you want to, if you want to do that or not, because it again adds to this military commitment that has, you know, benefits as well as other issues associated with that. So it's something to consider, but that's kind of the quick process on it.
Stay with us. We'll be right back with more about military anesthesia.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
All right, and we're back with Kyle.
Great. Thanks, Kyle. So let me ask you a couple questions. So one, that initial kind of 5-week training camp, you're obviously still in college, right, when that happens, because you haven't been to med school yet. So that you just sort of take, is it in the summer or do you take some time off? When do you do it as a college student?
Most commonly it is done the summer before you actually start med school. So I think usually it's around July, August is you start med school. So it's 5-6 weeks beforehand. Some people can actually take it after their first year going into their second year. I wouldn't recommend that because you've got so many other things going on with med school. So that's.
Okay. So that happens maybe the summer after you graduate college. And then the military is paying for all 4 years of medical school plus giving you a stipend. And for that, you owe them forget about, you know, the fellowship for a second, just from them paying for medical school, what do you owe them?
So you essentially owe them a year for a year. So it's 4 years. There are variables, like some people will join late for a scholarship and you might only owe three, but it's mainly a year for a year.
Okay. And then if you either do your residency in the military, in which case you're at a military residency program, or like you said, you get a civilian deferment and you do it in a regular, what I would consider a, you know, a the kind of programs I looked at are just a regular anesthesia residency program, non-military, or I guess civilian would be the word. Does that matter in terms of your time? Do you still owe time for, do you pay back any of the time if you're in the military residency as opposed to a civilian residency, or no, you don't pay any time back during residency?
No, the benefit, I guess, would be if you're due a military residency is that you earn pay and rank during that time, but it doesn't eliminate the 4 years required afterwards. So you're going to be, having an officer captain type pay where you're making almost $100,000 is a huge deal as a resident versus, on the civilian side. But there's other things to consider on, especially exposure on the civilian side. Getting your cases is a lot easier on the civilian side than the one program that the Air Force offers. And that's just, the way it is.
Okay. So after you finish residency, you still owe 4 years. But if you choose to do a fellowship, you're going to owe 2 additional years for each year of fellowship. Is that right?
That's what it was when I was applying through.
And if you do a civilian residency, are you guaranteed to be able to do a fellowship, or you have to get permission from the military to do a fellowship?
You have to also apply and ask essentially to get permission, because they're expecting and they've budgeted you to come out at that future date.
Okay. So that's a potential downside, is that you're kind of not totally your own. You're in control of your own career, right? You exactly. May or may not be allowed to do a fellowship, even if you want to do one, and even if you're willing to pay back the additional years. Okay. So then you finish training with or without a fellowship. Let's say you don't do a fellowship. You finish your residency. You now owe 4 years in the military. And obviously that's going to be whatever branch of the military you're in your case, the Air Force. You work then as an anesthesiologist in the Air Force for those 4 years?
Correct. Yeah. So you'll do... there's about 6 actual military treatment facilities that have surgical services. So there's not a lot of places that you can go, but ultimately you rank them towards the end of your residency on where you'd prefer to go. But it's really the needs of the Air Force on a lot of things and where you'll end up being. I was stationed at Keesler Air Force Base on the Gulf Coast here and San Antonio, Vegas. There's various ones. But the largest one's going to be the one in San Antonio. The one I'm at had, 6 ORs, maybe 2 or 3 endo suites. So they're pretty small community-based, essentially, hospitals that you're going to be working at in the military or the Air Force side.
Okay. And now, of those 4 years, how much of that time is spent working in the U.S., kind of at a military base, versus deployed internationally with the military?
So for the most part, it's going to be completely maybe deployed in a 4-year time period, maybe twice, which is a 6-month deployment for the most part. Otherwise, you're going to be stationed at that base and you likely won't be moving to a new base in that 4-year period, because it's just they don't usually move the doctors around as much as they would the other military members for just continuity purposes. But the deployments are usually 6 months long, so you should at least expect 1 or 2 out of that.
And you can obviously be sent anywhere the military needs you. What is the work like? What is the set? I mean, I guess it probably depends on where you go, but maybe could you give us an example or maybe an interesting clinical experience from one of your own deployments, if you're willing to share?
Yeah, so I mean, with the... First, on the military side, in the Air Force, Army, it is going to be a little different. The exposure to the CRNA staff as well, they're completely independent. There is no supervising. There is no, your boss may even be a colonel CRNA that you kind of answer to. So those are the kind of dynamics that you kind of have to work through, especially coming out as a new grad that you're really trying to get your feet under you, as well as study for your oral boards, all those things. But ultimately, those dynamics, everyone's going to be doing their own cases at the military treatment facilities. But once you get ready for a deployment, there's really 2 ways an anesthesiologist can deploy in the Air Force. Might be different in the Army, but they have a critical care and air transport team, which is essentially you act as a critical care doc, transporting patients from forward deployed locations in C-130 or planes coming back even from Germany to the U.S. And keeping taking care of them en route. Those deployments can be anywhere from 3 to 6 months. The other more commonly deployed situation, which is what I was on, is what they call a ground surgical team, which is a surgical team made of 6 members, anesthesiologist, a surgeon, OR nurse or ER nurse, surgical tech, and then ER doc, and then kind of a senior admin type of a member. So it's a 6-person team that has to be forward deployed, able to forward deploy with minimal equipment, but still should be able to take care of at least 3 critical patients needing surgical intervention. So that training takes several months to do before you actually get spun up to go on a deployment. I did that. I was out 1 year from residency, and then I started that training, and then I was sent to Qatar for a month with plans to be there the entire 6 or 7 months, but things changed and we got forward deployed from there to go to Jordan and Syria, where I sent you go from in Qatar. It's beautiful. You got places to stay and it's great. And then where we went, it was not, it was definitely eye-opening, but it was the tip of the spear that you kind of expect when you join. And it makes you kind of appreciate the real reason you're in the military. It's not until you really get out there and start taking care of people that, you know, if anyone goes on missions, like just the amount of, you know, tragedy that goes out there that it can be easily avoided, or even just surgical interventions that we take for granted that sometimes we can, that we can provide to our coalition forces out there or family members. If needed, is really beneficial. But when it comes to like a actual case or event that happened, you know, there was various gunshots between coalition members and trying to make sure I won't say anything I can anyways. But ultimately, we have coalition forces that work with us and our military members that Syrian army also knows who they can and cannot shoot at, and ultimately had to take care of a few of them. There was the general of the members that were helping our team out the most. His kid had an incarcerated hernia. He was 12 kilos and hadn't been eating for 4 days. Glucose was down into the 30s. He was essentially shocked, you know, needed this taken care of. So we're doing surgery in a room, dirt floors, flies, and we're trying to take care of this kid, and all my equipment is meant for an adult military member. Our vents that we fly up into Syria with are the size of a shoebox. Essentially, my meds had to be all adjusted. Everything's Teva. There is no gas. You kind of do what you have to do to save this kid because we want his dad to maintain, you know, relations with our forward deployed members that are really out there fighting. So there's a lot of that going on that people don't see or hear about, but there wasn't any, we're not really ramped up right now over there. So there's not a lot of active trauma that came in for our team while we were there, but just some of the things that we did.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for your service. I can't imagine how challenging and you know, difficult that must be to do that kind of medicine, and for a lot of reasons. So I'm really grateful to you and your colleagues for doing it. Did you do 4 years, or how long did you serve in the Air Force? I believe you had just finished your time. Is that right?
Yeah, 4 years.
Okay. And so you now, tell me if I'm right here. I think when you finish, you obviously could stay in full time. You've done your required commitment. Some people choose to stay. You can leave, I think, and again, I might be wrong here, so you'll tell me, but I think you can leave completely, or you can leave but still kind of stay in the reserves, right? Is that right?
Yeah, so the, several members will try to, especially if they did the civilian or did their residency in the military, those years kind of will count towards some reserve time. So you've already committed a lot of time in what they call points. So if you can do your reserves, the benefit of that also, I've got a doc who's in my group here now that I'm private practice, but he is doing reserves and he's able, because we all have to pay for our own insurance, so he's able to buy, TRICARE and for his entire family of six or seven kids, he's able to actually cover them with very, you know, a really small bill relative to me having to get private insurance.
Now, so did you opt not to do the reserves? Is that right?
Yeah, I just got out. And then, I mean, that's always an opportunity here going forward, but just wanted to get out completely first and then make that decision.
Great. All right. Well, congrats on finishing your time. And again, thanks for all your service. Now, we could obviously talk to you about private practice now that you've started that, but let's turn to Joe and hear his thoughts. So, Joe, you obviously, we know, did a fellowship in an academic center at The Ohio State University with Dr. Esando here. And then you, I think, went straight into private practice in a community setting. So tell us a little bit about why you chose that instead of staying in academics.
Sure. So I was interested in academics and private practice, and I couldn't really decide. But the one thing that I noticed doing my cardiac anesthesia fellowship was, hey, I kind of miss OB. And some people may be tuning into this podcast and think I'm crazy for saying that, or some people may do just OB, but I missed OB and I missed peds and I missed doing my blocks. And so I really wanted to be able to do everything in anesthesia. So that was sort of my biggest draw to choosing to go into it. Now, at the same time, I knew by doing that, I would have to give up some things. Like, it's pretty hard to find a mixed practice job where I'm doing general and cardiac and still be able to be doing the heart transplants and the LVADs, like the durable VADs. And so that was sort of a downside to me not going into academics or a bigger center.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, I realize Kyle, we did not ask you about a day in the life. Now, obviously, that would vary a lot based on whether you were deployed or not. But I'm going to say that, and you tell me if I'm right, that, you know, when you're here at the military base, your day is probably, you know, you said you're doing your own cases. So that's one way in which it's different, but it's probably not that dissimilar from being in a private practice if you were doing your own cases in private practice, other than that you're taking care of military members. When you're deployed, as you said, it could be in a very nice, you know, hospital in Qatar, or it could be, you know, on a dirt floor in Syria. So very, very different. And anything you want to add to that? Obviously, you know it better than I do.
I mean, obviously, the challenges of deploying and leaving your family and that that kind of weighs on you, you know, every day you're out there, but you're trying to make the most out of your time. But, you know, ultimately, being a forward deployed unit, we were always on call, had to have all of our equipment ready. You know, I used one or two backpacks that I had to have all of my vents, everything available, and all my meds. So it's just one of those things you kind of just keep checking and checking and waiting. But you have a lot of downtime on deployment. For me, I had no internet and I was preparing for my oral boards so by myself. So it was kind of a lonely time out there, but it was at least time I could get away from the kids and get ready.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. All right. So, Joe, let's go back to you. So, you know, you talked about kind of your decision and some of the pros and cons, things you had to give up, but what you got kind of in exchange in terms of being able to do more than just cardiac. Tell me a little bit about who typically employs anesthesiologists in the community. Are you working for a practice, for a hospital? Does it depend? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So it's kind of a changing landscape. So I'd say if you take a peek at how things were in the early 2000s or so, things were mostly what we think of as a traditional private practice. So that would be like a private group of doctors. They're owned. There are partners in the group, and a partner is basically like an owner of a company. To become a partner, you typically would start out as employed, and they call a partner track, and you could basically put in kind of either you pay or you do basically sweat equity, where you would work for less money for a couple of years and then you become partner if they chose. So that's sort of the kind of older kind of partnership private practice that still is around, but it's not quite as common. The other things that are commonly seen is you could be employed directly by the hospital system. So that's not too uncommon, where you may work for the community hospital, or you may work for it may be a hospital network and they employ you. Or kind of the other third big category is the physician management companies, or sometimes people call them anesthesia management companies. So there are several big ones in the country: Napa, Northstar, InVision are like three that come to the. And they're basically these big national companies, and they employ anesthesiologists and CRNAs and AAs, and they basically have contracts with hospitals to provide anesthesia services, and they take care of the billing, the insurance, the HR. They take care of all that stuff, and then you're not a partner in these groups. You're employed for a set wage and set vacation and that sort of thing. So those are sort of the three big employers that I'm familiar with.
Yeah, that sounds like what I've heard as well. So you're in the community setting. You kind of talked about some of the pros and cons of that. But if you had to say, what's your favorite part of working in the community setting? What keeps you there as opposed to going back to private practice?
I think it's great that
to academics. I said private practice. I meant going to academics. No. What keeps you in private practice?
Sure. The breadth of the cases and the variety of the cases is probably what I love. Like, I love doing cardiac anesthesia. That is my favorite by far. But sometimes it gets monotonous, and you want to do something different. So there might be, a day when our PEDS fellowship trained people are on vacation or post call. So I might have to do some PEDS, and I think that's great. And now by PEDS, I'm not fellowship trained in PEDS, but they're a healthy PEDS, and they're typically come in for MRI or ear tubes or something that even a guy who's fellowship trained in cardiac for adults can figure out. Or I get to go to OB or ECT, or so. Like, I just love that I get to do everything. That's probably my that would be something where if I did you do, or Mike does, I mean you guys might change the world, and I can't do that, but I get to do a little bit of everything else. So yeah,
sure. And what do you miss the most about academics? I mean, you spend obviously your residency and then fellowship, so you've got some experience. What do you miss the most about it?
I feel sometimes like I get concerned that I'm not challenged by my peers and colleagues to stay up to date with journals and the latest and greatest and that kind of thing. I mean, my community group, we do try to do journal clubs and that sort of thing, but it's not the same as being with people that are educating and that kind of stuff. So, so I miss that, like the camaraderie of academics and always talking about this article in anesthesiology that Mike Essendo published or something. I can't do the same big cases. Like, I still do big cases. I still do type A dissections and triple valves for endocarditis, and I do a ton of structural heart. So I get to do some really cool stuff, but at the same time, like, I'm not doing LVADs, and I'm not managing ECMO, and I'm not doing heart or liver transplants. So that's sort of the that's the downside and some stuff that I really miss in the community setting.
Okay. Tell me about a day in the life for, you know, you, to the extent that you can connect that to what an average day in the life looks like for someone in private practice anesthesia.
It's actually really not that different from what you had described for like a typical day. So the, so I get my assignment the evening before, and I typically start off with 3 to 4 rooms, and I go through those patients' chart in the EMR at home, and I do like a skeleton pre-op, and I make sure there's nothing crazy, and then cases start at 7:30, so I usually get there 6:15, 6:30. I see my 3 to 4 patients, and I'm typically supervising the RNAs. Cases get going, help with intubations, lines. Some days I'm dedicated to like TEE and structural heart. So if I'm in a structural heart room and I have to help with a TEE guidance for, say, like a Watchman amulet or a mitral clip or something, then it's just me. Or if they're lucky, if I'm lucky, there'll be a CRNA who's free that helps me. And then the biggest thing in private practice is when you go home typically depends on when you're going to be on call or when you were on call. So once in a while, you'll have to work post-call, not too much. But if it happens, you're typically the first one out. If you're on call the next day, that person gets out at a decent time, hopefully, and you're basically go home as the rooms start to come down. There is a relief system, but the relief is just from like the next people in the pecking order to go home. And then you go home and you start all over for the next day. So that's my typical day.
Fair enough. Now, do you ever do any of your, so you said when you're structural heart, you do those alone. Are you ever in an OR doing your own cases?
Yeah. So sometimes like if there's like a single case at the surgery center where it doesn't make sense to send a CRNA for one-to-one. So like a surgery center that may happen, or if there's like, if the numbers just don't not work out and it's just from a staffing standpoint, like it makes sense to have the doc staff say it's just a day where MRI needs covered at 7:30, and then there's a case in radiology, and then there's a private practice a GI doc who has a couple endos. You may be like the float doc, and you're just doing those cases, and there's no CRNA or resident. So, I mean, and I don't mind doing that from time to time. I think it keeps my skills up. I still know how to sign into the Pyxis and that sort of thing. So,
yeah. And we should say, I think I may have mentioned earlier, you know, there are certainly times in private, in academics where you are going to do your own cases. Mm-hmm. I think it varies at Hopkins. It's relatively rare. I think at some other places it's more common, but you know, you will occasionally, or maybe more often in academics, still have a room as an attending on your own. And it is a nice, opportunity to remember how to do all that. Locums work is something people are hearing a lot about, especially these days. My understanding of this, Joe, and you'll tell me what I'm missing, is that people often practices need extra anesthesiologists. That may be because someone went out on leave or someone is sick, or maybe these days because everyone's desperate for staff. And so there are agencies that will kind of hire you and then find places for you to go. It might be to cover for a week, a month. It might be for longer, shorter. But you kind of get short stints in different places, almost like a traveling nurse might travel around. That's my understanding of it, but I've never done it. Is that right? Or what do you want people to know about locum's work?
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty much true. I mean, I've done some in my case. I didn't go through a agency. I basically had some opportunities and some connections and people that said, hey, we need some help. If you're interested in coming up to our practice, you know, or, and, you usually use your, so if you're like me, you know, I just go on my, my vacation weeks. And if you're kind of, if you're kind of new to practice and you still have a ton of student debt and that sort of stuff, and you know, it's kind of nice. I will say I didn't feel comfortable doing it till I was about 2 years out. So my first job was great, and I had mentorship even from the other private practice guys. So I think I really needed that for my first job out. So I don't think I would do locum tour, because you're basically thrown into environments where you know nothing for a short period of time. So you don't know the quality of the surgeons you're working with, or the quality of the hospital, or how to do stuff. So I would say it's a great way to practice anesthesia, and it makes some extra money. But I don't know if I would do it as a new grad. That's not to say you can't. That's just sort of how I felt. Now, Jed, you had talked about a perk of being in academics and practicing general and critical care. I work with a gentleman who does strictly locums work, and he is boarded in anesthesia and critical care medicine. So he'll do 1 week of anesthesia, and then he'll go somewhere else and he'll do critical care for a few weeks and manage patients on ECMO in the ICU at big centers and that sort of stuff. And then he'll get sick of that, and then he'll have a contract someplace else, and he'll come back to anesthesia. So I will say that in most private groups, that's really hard to do, just because it's hard to find ways to compensate people for scheduling people for calls, for figuring all that stuff out for ICU and anesthesia. But he's a guy in his mid-career, and he's made it at work as locums, and he's an excellent clinician. And so that's just another thing that I never thought about till I met him. So
yeah, that's really interesting. Thanks, Joe. All right. This has been great. I think we've really given some good overviews of the three career paths we've discussed today, and people can obviously look more into the different options if they're interested. Let's turn to the part of our show where we make random recommendations. I want to hear what you guys are checking out these days that you'd recommend the audience also check out. Joe, why don't we start with you? What do you got to recommend?
So I just got a book as a gift from one of my colleagues. It's called The Baby Owner's Manual. It's by a pediatrician called Louis Bergenick. I hope I said his name right. And so I have my first child coming in April, and it's basically this book that is like babies for dummies, and it seems really helpful. So if anyone's expecting, I would suggest you check out this pediatrician's book called The Baby Owner's Manual.
That is awesome. And congratulations, Joe, on your upcoming first child. I will say, if I wasn't married to a pediatrician, I probably would have needed that book, but I had a built-in manual in our house, which made a huge difference. Kyle, how about you? What do you recommend?
This book's kind of a longer read, but Fingerprints of the Gods. I think it's by Graham, I think Hancock. He's ultimately speaks on kind of the natural wonders of our world, and ultimately trying to figure out maybe there's alternative reasons why things are were created not following necessarily the same archaeology or geology thoughts, and giving alternative views on some of these things that we see.
Great, very interesting. All right, thank you. And Mike, what do you got for us?
Yeah, my recommendation is there's this show on Showtime. It's Billions. It's a TV series on Showtime. It's a great show. It's based on a hedge fund manager, and some of his activities are not great at best. He's successful, but not what you want to, you know, not the kind of success you want to, you know, you want to be associated with. But it's a phenomenal show. It's been around for maybe six seasons, And they have a new season this year, and I just got into it. So if anybody has some free time, I think Billions is a great show.
Awesome. Yeah, we watched, oh man, the first several seasons of that, and then we stopped, but it was a lot of fun. Well, I'm going to recommend, I just saw, actually with my oldest daughter last weekend, the new Avatar movie, The Way of Water. And we saw it on the big IMAX 3D screen, which, you know, there aren't a lot of movies, I think, I mean, people can disagree, that I think are really worth it to see on that kind of screen, but this is one of them. And if you saw the first Avatar, you'll know that James Cameron just does an amazing job with really creating just incredible scenery and animation and, you know, effects. And to see it on the big screen was pretty awesome. I think the storyline itself was slightly less compelling than the first one, but it was still very interesting. It's long. It's about 3 hours and 15 minutes. So you have to be ready for a long haul, but it was a lot of fun to see. And I actually, to kind of pair along with that, there's a really interesting interview on the podcast Smartless of James Cameron, where he talks about both this movie and the fact that there are, I believe they filmed three of them at the same time, this one and then the two that will come, one every year for the next 2 years until it is finished. So that'll be really fun to see too. All right, gentlemen, this has been great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Chad.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chad.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Dr. Brian Park is our tech lead. Sonia Amanat and Chris Reese are our social media managers. Dr. April Liu and Edison Jang are our production assistants. Thank you so much for all that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today for the ACRAC podcast. I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.